So the subject is how our stories get stuck. They get stuck and they give us a lot of pain. And after the visit to the museum this morning, it does raise a kind of related question about memory, because it's very much central to the whole discourse on what one does and how one relates to such a thing as the Holocaust. The discourse is really about memory, or one of the strong elements in this discourse. So what does one do? There is certainly in this country a great fear, as if by remembering the Holocaust we somehow have honoured those that died and those that suffered, and that's indeed right. But also there's a sense that maybe if, and we heard it this morning, maybe by remembering the Holocaust we can in a way prevent it happening again. And that is questionable. There's a question in that. And, you know, they say that those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. You know that phrase. But I think actually those who remember history often also doomed to repeat it. And it's not enough. I don't think, you know, it's a personal view. I don't think Israel is in great shape right now, I'm afraid. And it's, and part of the problem, I think, is creating a certain type of memory of the Holocaust, which is an icon. The memory is served and held and turned into an icon and almost an act of worship. And then it kind of prevents the ability to really look at ourselves and who we are and what we are, because we have this icon in front of us. So memory has got positive and negative qualities. And I think it really emphasizes the importance of what we do here. And when I told my wife over lunchtime, Rachel, that we went to the museum, and she said, you don't realize how important the work that you're doing here is right now, us together, because it's so unusual to do this kind of work in an atmosphere where such a thing is turned into icons, the memory is expanded, it's become a political, it's, you know, used by politicians for personal benefits, for etc., 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 etc. And so we have to ask, what is the work that we're doing here that actually works and seems to work better? And so I want to kind of work on that. It's obviously the Dharma wisdom and the Dharma compassion. But what is that? How does that work? What is that? What kind of Dharma wisdom are we talking about? I think we need to go back to something very, very simple. Experience that we experience has a beginning and an end. Painful or pleasant, it has a beginning and an end. We tend, because of some very basic need for survival, our basic vulnerability, our basic insecurity, our basic fears, we hang on. And we hang on especially to experiences that are painful. We keep busy with them. They get stuck in us. We are busy with them. You know the Buddhist story of the second arrow. That what causes suffering is not the first pain. The story is someone got hit by an arrow, and the arrow then went down, fell down. But the person who got hit by the arrow picked it up and carried on hitting himself with the arrow. That's the second arrow. So that, this is what we do. We suffer, and it's just pain. But then we keep busy with it in the way we build around it our stories about our suffering, our victim patterns, our angers, our rage and wanting to give back to somebody, our depressions when we feel helpless or we feel unable to deal with the pain, our struggle inside, our struggle with everybody else. We are busy. And it's exactly as the as Renata was saying yesterday, suffering is the moving towards constantly what we want and away from what we don't want, and being very, very busy with that. So experience itself is arising and passing, but the busyness, the way we work with it, we hold it, we get stuck with it, we are busy with it, we put it on a, like the icon of the Holocaust, icon, we put it on the stage, and then it controls us, and it's right there all the time, and we're afraid of letting it go. So that process of hanging on is, in the Pali, is called upadana. It's sometimes translated as attachment. It's a second noble truth. But it's a bit more than attachment. The meaning of the word is the fuel, what we feed, what we give fuel to, the fire that we keep giving fuel to. So we keep feeding the same fire. Upadana is what we feed. Which is a little bit, attachment is a bit of a psychological word. This is a little bit more about deep, deep habits of what it is that we feed. So very simply, addiction. We have an addiction to something. I have, for the last 50 years, had an addiction to several cups of English tea every day. And I have to tell you that 2 weeks ago, I finished it. Those of you who run to me and give me cups of tea because they think they know my habits may have noticed that I haven't drunk one cup of tea in the last 2 weeks. I've stopped. And I'm just, it's a small example, but I'm feeding it. I have a relationship with my English tea. It's my culture. But it's an addiction. And it's being fed. By every time I do it, I'm ready for the next time. That's feeding. There's four, in the Dharma, there is four kinds of feeding, of attachment. The first is attachment to things through the senses, which is definitely the category of my English tea addiction. The senses, what I want, what I like, what I find tasty, what I find I need, what's good for me, what I understand I need. And what I don't need, what I don't like, is running away, is pushing away, is it's very deep, it's very basic. For those that don't know, this really classic example that's given in the Buddhist teaching, and a very kind of classic picture, is the monkey trap. How you catch a monkey in the Himalayas, where you put a coconut shell nailed to a tree, and it has a hole in it. And the hole is just the size that the hand can go in. Then you put a banana inside the coconut shell. The monkey puts his hand in to take the banana. He grasps the banana, but then his hand is too big to get out. So he's stuck. And he will not let go the banana. He will not let go of the banana. But I have another image just came, which is it's very similar from Winnie the Pooh. I seem to remember that Pooh came into Piglet's house one day when Piglet or Rabbit wasn't there and ate all the honey that he found, and then he couldn't get out, right? And he was totally stuck, and there was someone pushing him from the back and someone pulling him from the front, and he just couldn't get out of the... It's somewhat similar. The second is attachment to views. And we can see how devastating, how terrible that can be. I mean, we're just coming from the Holocaust Museum, the view of the National Socialists in Germany. They had a view about the Jews. They had a view, and then everyone shared the view and it became a truth. Of course it's like that. Of course they're like that. Of course we need to do this. Of course, except for a few brave souls that said, no, it's a view and I'm not going along with it. But nearly everybody, you see the power of a view to catch everybody, call it reality, and then it's obvious. And then everything confirms it. Everything you see confirms it. It proves it, because that's what you see. So a view, once you're caught, is a very major issue. It can be devastatingly painful and destructive. It's still a view, and it's still an attachment. And it's worth knowing that. It's not reality, it's attachment. A third area of attachment, or upadana feeding, is the whole structure of rules, rituals, how we ought to behave, what are the structures that we have to keep, and don't look at me as a Dharma teacher putting a timetable up on the board and saying 10 o'clock this and 11 o'clock that, and you must do this and you must keep silent. But even that, we can let go of. Yeah, they're just a convenient way of learning something. But it gets much more serious when the rules and the rituals become ways of making us do things against others who are not the same. Then we start believing what the gurus say, what the rabbis say, what the priests say, everything. We get authority from that, and we stop to think. We just behave like others tell us. And that's a major attachment and often a major harm. I don't know if you know the story of Angulimala. It's a very dramatic story in the suttas of a brigand that was his guru told him, you have to kill 1,000 people. And because he believed his guru, for some offense that the guru suffered, some insult, he just went and did it. And he killed 999, and he was about to kill the Buddha, but the Buddha stopped him and turned him into a monk. So it's another form. And we have to be very, very watchful about these things. They catch us when we don't realize. They catch us and they look sometimes very nice and very good. We have to be really careful what steals our inner freedom, our real basic freedom. What steals our freedom? It's always attachment. Be very watchful. And sometimes, well, I'll talk about it in a minute. And the big one is attachment to me. The fourth one is attachment to self. Self, who I am, my identity, how I define myself. And as you were saying in our little group just before, how much It's a dream. It's an illusion. A delusion. I'm a German. Yeah, they call me a German. That's what you say. But where is it being a German? What is it? Where is being a Israeli, English, Jewish? I don't know what. What is this identity? How we hold on to it, we act from it, we have a role in life, we dress in certain clothes, and we speak a certain language, and we speak a certain, and we have identity, and we believe, but it's total. And we forget that it's also an attachment. I remember my first realization. My first questioning about being Jewish, and that was when I was quite a small kid. I kept asking my father, "Well, where am I Jewish?" "Well, this hand, well, this hand, which, where am I Jewish?" "Oh, go away, leave me alone." Because it's obviously, you know, you can't answer it, it's attachment. It's based on illusion. It's based on ignorance. It makes us suffer. All of these makes us suffer. And the attachment catches us when we don't expect it. I mean, I've got an example here which is quite close to me and to us here in the village. Because when we came to this village, we were very free-thinking, kind of coming from the squatting community of London and of Jerusalem. We were very much kind of an alternative society. And then we bought land. And it's amazing how every one of us were utterly caught in becoming landowners. All of a sudden, we had our own land. Our own land. And all these kind of old hippies suddenly turned into landowners and didn't like it if others started to come on, or want their land, or wanted to put a fence across, or want to graze their goats on it, or want to, or argued about it and pushed the fences here, and you know, people started to be it's just very natural. I was the same. It caught me as well. Suddenly I was a landowner, and people were walking on my land. I would find out who they were, what they wanted. I didn't think it was just land that was belonged to the universe. Suddenly it was my land, and I had to really watch it and be careful about it and kind of we do need, in a way, we do need belonging. And very often when we discuss attachment in the Dharma, people say, with some justification, "Well, I need my attachments. Do you mean to say I shouldn't be attached to my family? Do you mean to say I shouldn't be attached to my house or my country or my piece of land? I should give it away? What actually do you mean?" And I think that there is a subtle understanding here that we can bring. That indeed, we do need relationships. We do need closeness with others. We do need to be caring for our children. We don't want to throw our baby away and say, "You know, mustn't be attached, so go away." We need, and there's something healthy about being connected. But being deeply connected is not the same as being attached. And that's that is a difference. We mix attachment with closeness. We make a confusion between the two. Closeness, belonging, a sense of love and caring is an existential experience in the moment. Attachment is, on top of that, a kind of a hanging on. And you see it in families when the closeness and the love and the sense of intimacy becomes attachment, then it becomes control. Because the family member just doesn't want the other to do certain things that might threaten them. So then you get the husband jealous of the wife who talks to somebody else, or the mother who just fights with the daughter because she's going out, or the father that fights with the son because he wants to do something different than what the father wants him to do, etc., etc. And this kind of control comes from attachment. So I think that there is a difference between healthy, something which is development, and the development of a child, for example, which is engagement, and something unhealthy, which is imprisonment in all kinds of ways. There is a difference between growing up and waking up. Growing up, you need closeness, and you need even a healthy, you would say, the beginnings of attachment, more like bonding. Waking up is another process where you can begin to question, where's the freedom? What is freedom for me? So, the issue about attachment is that we actually don't see it. We become constructed. Day before yesterday, I talked about sankharas, constructions in the mind, and that the identity is one of them. But our ignorance is that we believe these attachments to be true. We believe them to be facts. And they can get quite painful when they are narratives that we constantly tell ourselves, and we are stuck with them. And here's where we get close to issues or stories. A story like, I'm not good enough. I need to be better. I need to fix something. I need to be fixed. I'm inadequate. I don't think much of myself. I'm humiliated. We were talking about this morning too, in our small group, how the rise of the, in a way, the Third Reich, the National Socialists in Germany, came because of a deep sense of humiliation or lack of worth of the German people after the First World War. And so it was very fast when a new, supposedly free empowerment could arrive in the form of the National Socialists. And it just tells us the problem of this narrative called, I'm not good enough. That's just a small example. Many examples of narratives like that. And some of these narratives, even if they have attachment in them, are not so bad. I don't want to say that we have to kind of take an anesthetic and wipe out every story that we tell ourselves. This is not the point. And some stories are really beautiful stories, of course. And even some senses of who our role are very positive. The Buddha was asked many times, so through attachment to an identity or to a role. So what about a role as a Dharma practitioner? That's a role. I'm a Buddhist practitioner. The monks of the Buddha had a certain role, had a certain identity, had a certain attachment to their robes and to their bowl and to their way of life. There was attachment there. And the Buddha said, yeah, well, I recognize this, but it's the best of attachments. It's an attachment, but it's the best one. It's like I once challenged a very wise rabbi, and we talked about there's a very strong issue in Jewish life against worshipping idols and icons and statues and so on. And I challenged this rabbi, and we had a discussion. We actually had a retreat on idols and icons and the issues of that with Christians and Jews together. And I said, so I gave a long list of icons and idols inside Jewish life. Many, there are many. The Torah scroll, I mean, that's an object, but also different sorts of icons that I just talked about. The Holocaust is an icon, and many, many others. And he said that's true, that it's the nature of human beings to create icons and then worship them, but he thinks Judaism is the best idol worship he knows. Which I think is very right on honest. So yes, we can be a Buddhist practitioner, and it is an icon or a role, and it is a self, and it is selfing, and it is becoming something. But the Buddha said, yeah, it's okay. But in the end, we have to let go also of that. That temporarily we can take on roles and icons if they're good. Temporarily we need a healthy growth as a child and be a healthy self. And there's no point in talking to a child and say, the Buddhists say that there's no self, so why are you growing up to a self, to be a somebody? You can't say that, and it's not wise, because growing up needs a healthy self. But you do need to be wise and see the limits of this attachment, where it takes you, what it is it does to you, where you can let go, and grow strong and steady, and then you can let go more. The more steady you are, the more you can let go, and you're fine without. You're fine without this and this and this icon and this attachment and this identity and this. In the end, I would say the Enlightenment teaching, and we not forget that we are in this circle here. There is an intention for awakening, and that is not just another story that we tell ourselves. And it's about seeing very clearly that all these attachments, these roles, the attachments that we build up are some kind of a prison, bit by bit, opening the doors and letting in the light. And the big one is the self. And we need to keep doing that. We need to keep going with that. It's all our life. We need to open that door and let in the light. Someone once asked a Zen practitioner, why does everything seem so difficult in life? Why am I so unhappy? He said, you're unhappy because 99.9% of all you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. So, what are we going to do about it? I think that we need to go back again and again, and the Dharma says this again and again and again in all different ways, and this is the kind of bottom line of the whole Dharma teaching. We need to go back and ask ourselves, what is the moment, a moment of real experience? What is it that we actually experience right now, in this moment? And if we do that, things look very, very different. Now, when we ask, what is this experience? It means now. And it means being quite fast to get in there quite quickly and see the first moment of experience, the first thought, the first response, the first, just to get in there, you know, you say in English, to nip it in the bud. You know, when you're pruning the gizum, you, before it grows to a big, enough big branch, you take off the little bud. So it doesn't, and then you don't need to cut when it's already grown to a big branch that you don't want. So it's getting in there quickly and seeing the nature of the immediate experience. And in that immediate experience, which is what we actually experience, is what we, how we actually live. The constructions are kind of irrelevant. The build-up that we make out of it is not that interesting. It's the second thought, the third thought, the fourth thought, the fifth, the sixth, how we build on this and then this and then this, and then we eventually build a personality on top of that. It's about seeing the story as it arises, and if we see it as arising, then we don't need to believe in it. We see it as story arising and passing away. Can be the most difficult story. It's still a story. It's an experience, yes. It may be painful, yes. But it doesn't need us to create attachment. We don't have to be attached to it. There is a freedom in seeing our stories as they arise and pass away, our experiences as they really are. It's being in the natural flow of life. We are living beings. We experience things as they turn up, as they are, as they come and as they go. And they're really, that we don't actually need. It's not that we have to fight against any story. We just gradually realize we really don't need to be stuck with them. It's just that's the letting go of attachments. We actually don't need, but we have to see that. That I'm absolutely fine with the memory. I'm absolutely fine with a story. Let it come, let it go. I don't need to do anything with it. I don't need to build it up, make it something, get stuck with it. Let it control me, let it control other people, give trouble to the world, start wars because of it. It's not even interesting anymore, this story. It's arising and passing. I just don't need to serve it, to become a servant of my stories, a slave of my stories. That's like this famous phrase, the thought is a great servant and a terrible master. And that's that. We cannot, there is something delicate here in the practice. We can't force ourselves to let the attachment go. Letting go is very much a slogan. Yeah. And we talk about it all the time, letting go, letting go, letting go. It's not deep enough in a way, because when we really look at things, we actually don't need to let them go, but they let themselves go. Letting go means I have to somehow let them go and let them go and let them go. It often feels like hard work. But if we look carefully, everything lets itself go. Nothing really stays in its own nature. Its nature is arising and passing. So we don't actually have to get rid of anything. The most difficult things in us we don't have to get rid of. We don't have to be in the mode of fixing and repairing ourselves and sorting this and sorting that and giving a medicine for this and giving a medicine for that in our inner life. Because things, in a way, don't belong to us in the first place. When we really understand that, it all becomes a lot easier. Does it really belong to us? Does this story really belong to me? Is it mine? Do I own this story? Or is it something passing through me from others? Is it something I just picked up on the way? And when we look carefully and even ask the question, what it is that I really own? What is really mine? I think we'll discover that there's not much, not much there that we can say is really mine. I think we can discover it's not much there. The stories come in and out like water that we drink and then goes out as pee pee. Not mine. You think, oh, it's mine, but it isn't always so easy. I know that, you know, it's great to listen to a Dhamma talk and it makes it feel quite possible, everything, and I know it's not easy. Sometimes, indeed, we may have to go through quite a bit of mourning, you know, in the English word to mourn, and Hebrew would be litabel. It is true, we might have to go through difficulty, even in this retreat, some of the difficulties that were expressed at the beginning of the retreat were almost like, something's happening to me, I may be letting go of something, or I may be learning something, but it feels uncomfortable, I feel unsure, I feel homeless, or I feel insecure. And these feelings are there, and they are part of the process. And sometimes we do have to go through them, and they're not always so easy. So I don't want to say it's so easy, pretend it's so easy. When the snake gets rid of its skin, sometimes it really has to struggle. And then it finds a new skin. The old skin, it has to really squeeze itself out of the old skin. And it's not always, it can be painful a bit. But always, always, I think there's no snake that would ever say, oh, I wish I had my old skin. I want the old skin back. I think every snake would say, what a beautiful new skin I have. And every person that really experiences letting go of attachment, I don't know anybody that would say, oh, I wish I had it back again, this attachment. I needed it so much, and now I don't have it. And it's a discovery of so much lightness and freedom. And I don't know anyone that would want their attachments back. But during the process, they may say, oh, I can't let go of this, it's hard. We need to be kind, and this is where the constant reminder in this retreat and in other retreats to be kind, to be compassionate, makes it easier. It softens it's like putting oil on the skin if you have to get out of the skin. It makes it softer, it makes it easier to change, to let go of the old skin and emerge from the old skin of the snake. It's the oil on the skin. It softens the whole process. And we can basically, the realization that it doesn't belong to me anyway, it's just passing through me, which is the sort of founding understanding of non-attachment, goes with the compassion, which is, okay, doesn't belong to me, it belongs to everybody, but we're all in the same situation. We're all snakes having to get out of our skin. We're all struggling with the same attachments and the same difficulties and the same pains. So I am with everybody else going through the same process. And it makes sense. Compassion makes it easier, kindness makes it easier, softness makes it easier. I've done just loads and loads and loads of retreats with some pretty tough Dharma teachers who were pretty strict and tough and many, many hours and, you know, hard work. But I think that we need the balance. They would say the balance comes later, by softness coming afterwards. But first you need to discipline the mind to get out of your usual ignorance by some hard work. And I think we can start with a balance between wisdom and compassion right at the beginning. We don't need to wait. The two can work right at the beginning. They work very well together right at the beginning. So finally, the final word, to remember that upadana means to what we feed. And it's a reflection that's really important. When we get caught by attachments, or when we sustain them, we are actually feeding them. And when we want to undo the attachments, the insight that they don't really belong to us, or the insight that they're not so needed after all, or the fact that we know that simply a story comes and goes, and it doesn't have to be so important to us, all of that is taking away the fuel from the fire. So we don't have to, again, work so hard to put out the fire, or to work to struggle to become non-attached, to do surgery, to cut out the attachment with a knife. We don't need to do that. We just need to not feed all the time, to give fuel to this attachment, to this construction, to these constructions that give us pain, to these stories that give us pain. Just not to feed them. They're there. They'll be okay. They are there. They may be with us all our life. Interesting that Mara, that represents the ordinary mind of insecurity, attachment, ignorance, the Mara came to the Buddha all his life. The Mara didn't stop coming when the Buddha was enlightened. The Mara came all his life to the Buddha, kept coming. In other words, ordinary mind kept coming in every way. But it was pretty easy to send Mara away. All you had to do was see him. That's all you had to do. All the Buddha did was see Mara, and Mara went away. And that's all you need to do, is see it, see the attachment, see the reality that it comes and goes, see that it doesn't need to be sustained or put made into an icon, made into a control of us, made into a prison for us. Just need to see it. You don't need to work so hard to get rid of it, to cut it out, to fight it. Seeing is pretty well the whole thing. If you see it with deep wisdom and compassion, that's the job is done. And there's more and more freedom. Just more and more freedom. Freedom keeps expanding quite endlessly. Thank you.